This is Ron Orrell, and you're listening to the 100th episode of the Activist Investing Today podcast, and I couldn't be more excited to celebrate this milestone with Sagar Gupta, portfolio manager in charge of building out the activism investing strategy at Toronto-headquartered $2 billion investment fund, Anson Funds, which is led by Moaz Kazam. Sagar joined in October 2023 and comes from a top activist fund, Legion Partners, which I've written frequently about. In fact, we wrote an article today about them, where he led the investors activism investments in technology, media, and telecommunications sector. So TMT will be talking a little bit about that later on as well. It's been a busy few months for Sagar. In December, Five9 announced it had settled with Anson Funds to add Sagar to its board, which is a big deal. A lot of these settlements, I find it's outside people they get on the board, and Sagar was able to get on the board there. So congratulations. And soon after that, Anson launched a campaign urging Lionsgate Studios to set up an investor day and potential strategic review after the company is fully separated from its parent company. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later on. And we're going to also talk a little bit about a couple of your recent campaigns at Twilio and Globalstar. Thanks for taking the time, Sagar.
Thanks for having me, Ron. Happy to be here.
Happy New Year to you, too. So let's talk about Anson. Maybe you could just kind of give us a brief overview of the investment fund and its activist strategy and its overall portfolio focus, because I know the activism is a part of it.
Right. Yeah, sure. So Anson is a multi-strategy hedge fund, which means we execute a number of different investment strategies out of a main fund. Mm-hmm. That main fund, Moaz, oversees as the chief investment officer, and it's run close to market neutral with little to no leverage. Okay. The fund launched in 2007 with roughly $8 million, and it's grown to $2 billion primarily through very good, consistent performance. So a really special story and culture that Moaz has built. I joined to build out a long-term activism strategy where the portfolio has roughly five names at a time. As a firm, we like to focus down market cap, and our activism strategy targets the $1 to $10 billion market cap range in the US and Canada. Mm-hmm. And since I've historically focused on three sectors, tech, media, and telecom, that's where I've initially focused, but we'll expand over time. But so far, we've been very active across those three sectors and pleased with the strategy's performance, which has been rather strong versus, let's say, the Russell 2000 or HFRI Activist Index since inception.
Wow. Congratulations. That's great. And so the activism is, I guess, a part of that strategy. Talk a little about the activism strategy. And I always think of, at the very least, every activist that's a real activist buys a stake in a company and engages with that company. And so maybe you could talk a little about your engagement philosophy. I'm always curious, you know, do activists try to talk to the executives, directors, IR officers? Do companies make those people available to you? Tell me a little bit about your engagement strategy.
Yeah, sure. So we engage directly with boards and management teams, and our preferred approach is to do so privately and in a collaborative manner. We recognize that as public markets investors, there is an information gap between us as outsiders and the company's insiders. So it's important to approach them with a degree of humility and hear what they have to say. We, of course, have a view going in and may disagree with what we hear, but I think this philosophy and approach really helps us refine our recommendations to the board, which in turn helps build our credibility and the case for change. And having board experience ourselves also better allows us to appreciate that gap. I mean, there's a lot of times where a board may want to tell you something, but they simply can't. On the other hand, as we both know, Ron, not every board and CEO is interested in shareholder input, yet they continue to underperform. And those situations will likely require an escalated approach into the public realm, typically leading up to a proxy fight, which is always a last resort, but one that we are willing and able to do when necessary. So ironically, this creates a little bit of a PR challenge, and I'm putting that in air quotes, when an activist like us first shows up. They'll Google our firm, they'll Google my name, and they'll only see our public activity, which by definition will be more aggressive, like what happened at Twilio, for example. Mm-hmm. So it necessitates an effort on our behalf early on to describe constructive engagements we've had elsewhere, which obviously does not get media attention, which is fine. But I think we do a good job of that. And that all goes towards building our brand as an activist, as people get to know us.
Mm-hmm. So in many cases, companies will make people available to you, right? Like an IR official, directors, the executive, or that in most cases, you're engaging with the company prior to taking the campaign public. And in many cases, you never have to take the campaign public because you're able to kind of collaboratively engage with them privately. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's totally fair. And almost all the conversations are just with board and management. Mm-hmm. Very often you'll have the IR person in the room as well, but we're interacting with the top.
Okay. All right. So let's get into some of the fascinating campaigns you've worked on recently. Let's talk a little bit about Twilio. You mentioned it. It's a San Francisco-based communications company. Last January, Twilio announced that its founder and CEO, Jeff Lawson, would be stepping down. And that took place following discussions with Anson. And then a few months later, we wrote this up also, the communication company also reported that director Byron Dieter, a partner at VC firm Bessemer Venture Partners, was stepping down from the board, also following talks with Anson. So this seems like some serious leadership changes in response to Anson engagement. Tell us a little bit about your engagement with Twilio.
Yeah, just to describe what they do, Twilio is a communications infrastructure software company that created its category and still dominates today. It was started by Jeff Lawson. He's a brilliant entrepreneur and oversaw an extended period of hypergrowth. Unfortunately, over time, the cost structure got out of control and the company veered heavily away from its original strategy. In fact, Lawson wrote a book about the virtues of Twilio's original self-serve business model, which was key to its rapid success. And then soon after publishing that book, made a huge acquisition of a company with a totally different business model, which has been a disaster since. Mm-hmm. Altogether, this led the stock to crash 90% from its peak. I've been investing in this space for a long time, communication software, and always admired the company. So it was pretty sad to see it fall off the rails this badly. In terms of the campaign, I actually began the campaign at my old firm roughly 2 years ago.
And I remember that.
Yeah. And so I continued it at Anson when I made the switch in 2023. And by that time, I already had close to 10 meetings with the board and management, including presenting to them, et cetera. Over that year, the stock was flat. And by the end of 2023, it came time for us to deliver a simple message to the board. Same CEO, same strategy, not going to work. Mm-hmm. Either or both have to change. Mm-hmm. And on the day of our next scheduled meeting, January 8th last year, the company announced that Lawson was stepping down and his number two would be taking the top job. And so after the CEO change, another reputable shareholder entered the stock and was able to secure board representation, which was very much needed and we were happy to see. We also wanted to see the departure of one of the long tenured directors who helped enable the growth at all cost mindset that ended up destroying a ton of shareholder value. And we got that with Byron Dieter's departure from the board. He was also up for election. So these changes in aggregate helped avoid a proxy fight at the company. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say the new CEO deserves a lot of credit here since he accelerated the cost optimizations and capital returns that began in 2023 under our pressure. Mm-hmm. To put it in perspective, since the start of my campaign 2 years ago, headcount went from a peak of 9,000 to closer to 5,000 today, mm-hmm. which took EBITDA from close to negative 1 billion and to an expected positive 1 billion today. So, like, we're talking about a huge swing in profitability. And over this period, they also bought back almost 30% of the market cap. So with all of these improvements combined with a top line reacceleration following the change in CEO, the company's now on a great long-term path and the stock has doubled since we bought it at Anson.
Wow. And when you joined Anson, you kind of continued the campaign. So you allocated more capital. So you had invested a large stake. And then your previous fund, Legion, also, I guess, maintained a big stake, but you had led the campaign at Legion, so you kind of ran it at Anson. That's fair as well?
we're happy to see all shareholders win in this situation and in every situation.
Okay, it looks like I should probably do kind of a follow-up on Twilio since I last wrote about it when that VC firm director stepped down. And I guess a lot of improvement has happened since then. But let's talk a little bit about another one of your campaigns. This one I saw you introduce the campaign in December 2023 at a conference. And that's at Globalstar, which is a satellite spectrum communication company that at the time, I mean, you spoke about lots of different aspects of it, but at the deal, we always focus on the deal angle. And you called it a highly attractive acquisition target, in part because it's partner of Apple. So flash forward a year, Globalstar still remains independent, but its share price is up. So tell us about it.
Yeah, it's funny. A sale of the company is always one of many recommendations we can put forward at a company, usually towards the bottom of the list, but it always, without fail, dominates headlines. And right. I greatly appreciate that your outlet's called The Deal. So totally makes sense. But Globalstar, it's a good example where we've had very extensive collaborative engagement in the background, given our excellent relationship with the board and CEO, Paul Jacobs. He's the former CEO of Qualcomm. So very talented guy. And put simply, Globalstar is doing amazing work. Like you mentioned, they are the exclusive satellite partner to Apple, where they power all satellite communications on the iPhone, which is, by the way, a highly profitable business for Globalstar. The company also sits on a treasure trove of spectrum that's highly strategic. And under Paul's leadership, they greatly expanded their relationship with Apple, where a few months ago, Apple invested an additional $1.7 billion into the company. When this deal was announced, it represented almost the size of Globalstar's entire market cap. Wow. So, yeah. So the stock instantly doubled. And what's crazy about this deal was it's incremental to our original thesis, where we already saw Globalstar stock as a multi-bagger. The deal obviously enhances the company's strategic value and market positioning, making it an even more attractive acquisition candidate. So, you know, it's possible we'll see the company sold in the future, perhaps to Apple. They have a ROFR here, maybe to Elon Musk and Starlink since they need spectrum, maybe SoftBank, who's already an investor in the company. But given the tremendous value that they're building operationally, combined with far better investor communications, which we're helping them with, unless it's an amazing offer or the value creation teeters out, there's no rush. We're long-term investors and we're enjoying the ride in the public markets.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it sounds like this is a very collaborative campaign or collaborative situation at this stage.
Yeah, I'd say it's fairly representative of how we'd like things to go.
Okay, so I want to talk a little about Lionsgate Studios, because I thought that was quite an interesting campaign you launched this December. But I want to just kind of take a step back. And we've been talking a lot about technology, media, telecom companies, and that's your specialty, and you've invested in that space, which I thought was very interesting, because I used to talk to a lot of activists that very specialized in particular sectors. And you know, if a company in that sector showed up on their 13F report, that was a red flag for me, like, oh, that's probably a campaign. They're probably engaging. But lately, I feel like a lot of the activists are kind of generalists. And I don't know how I feel about that. So tell me, how's the specialization helped you? Do you plan to keep specializing with your activism in the TMT space? And just tell me a little bit about how that factors into your decision making.
Yeah. The question is, does specialization help? 100%. Yeah. Especially at our size and scale. I think the larger, well-known activists may be generalist as a firm, but they definitely have sector specialists within their ranks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Like Elliott Management has these specialists in different sectors, for example. Yeah, no, that's totally true. It's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's all for the same two reasons that we see as it being important. One, investment underwriting, and two, effectiveness/credibility in your activism. In the former, having deep industry knowledge enables you to spot ideas faster, conduct much deeper due diligence, and it helps you generate a very high quality set of recommendations to create value, including newer and perhaps more creative, unique ideas. because you know the space. Most importantly, having this knowledge allows you to better identify downside risk. Remember, most activists are making large concentrated investments. So if you're coming into a brand new sector, there's a higher chance you're going to miss a potential risk and lose a lot of money. And so, you know, that's reason number one. Reason number two, on the activism front, if you have a strong track record in those industries, you have a lot more credibility with the issuer because they can see what you've done at their peers. Your engagement will also likely move along a lot faster and be more effective, even with the small position size. So specialization also, to us, it means having a fantastic network within those industries, including executives, director nominees, private equity firms, bankers, consultants, and even lawyers. Ultimately, this is an investment strategy all about combining the right people with the right governance and making great things happen. And in that sense, a trustworthy network really goes a long way. Mm-hmm. In terms of expanding over time, yeah, we would love to build up that same expertise and network in healthcare, for example. And within Anson, we have a real estate investment team that has tremendous experience and connections. And so you may see some collaborations there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to talk about Lionsgate, but first let's kind of build into it a little bit. And I was interested when you launched the Lionsgate campaign at the Bloomberg conference in December, you had talked about AI and AI's impact. So maybe we could start, you know, view about AI and activism overall. And then maybe we could talk a little about your campaign at Lionsgate and how artificial intelligence factors into that.
Yeah, sure. So this is a great example where having a deep network and understanding of technology can really help, even if we're diving into a non-tech sector like media. So we see AI or advanced automation, whatever you'd like to call it, in activism a few different ways. In terms of target selection, we're value investors at heart and focus on small to mid-cap companies. Where AI is playing out in the public markets right now is largely two areas, mega-cap tech and small, highly speculative companies making all kinds of crazy claims around AI. And we're not chasing either of those buckets. What we're looking for are companies that will greatly benefit from the advent of AI, where it's not priced into the stock at all, either because the market is totally unaware of the opportunity, or because, in our opinion, the market incorrectly believes the company to be an AI loser when that's simply not the case. If we can help make these companies implement new AI strategies to either drive much higher cost efficiency and overall productivity, or even go after new business opportunities that never existed before or that were previously cost prohibitive, that can be a really interesting opportunity, especially when the stock is trading at a significant discount to the intrinsic value of its business today. Our targeted investment return is usually a double or a triple. And if we get it right on AI, we can possibly get there faster or reach even higher returns. In many cases, it's a massive call option worth exploring. So how exactly are we implementing this into our engagements? Just ourselves spending a ton of time in the space, believe it or not, we're able to work with management teams on being thoughtful around AI product strategies that can help drive growth. We're bullish, for example, on our investment in Match Group, the online dating company, and what they're doing around user onboarding with the AI photo selector, enhancements to the matching algorithm, AI assistance in direct messaging, and new safety and user authentication tools, all of which we believe should drive quality user growth and a higher propensity to pay for these services long term. In addition, we see what a lot of other companies are doing, both public and private, in terms of implementing AI to drive efficiency, and we can help replicate these best practices. We work with some brilliant consultants that do on-the-ground work implementing advanced automation across a company that can drive employee productivity and find incremental cost efficiencies. And once again, I have to touch on this again, but my point on having a great network, we can also propose director nominees with AI backgrounds.
Right.
That can really serve as a strong partner to management teams as they navigate this new and exciting world.
Yeah. No, I got to say, I kind of have a love-hate relationship with AI, as a lot of people do. A little bit of fear, you know, that AI will replace jobs and, I don't know, have some kind of negative impact on society in the future. But I feel like that there is definitely a place for AI at companies. So in that context, maybe you could talk a little about how you view AI at Lionsgate, for example. So Lionsgate, you launched this campaign in December, urging Lionsgate to set up an investor day, potentially consider a strategic review after the company is fully separated from its parent company. That's going to happen soon. The parent company will be renamed Starz after the TV network it owns, and the Lionsgate studio will own the studio business. So explain to me how AI factors into your campaign at Lionsgate.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about Lionsgate, because in my mind, this is a perfect example of where the AI opportunity is not obvious to the market, but it really should be. Lionsgate is a very well-known movie and television studio in Hollywood whose franchises include John Wick, The Hunger Games, Mad Men, and more. And simply put, it can be pretty damn expensive to make a blockbuster movie. Like, these guys don't do a ton of tent poles as compared to larger legacy studios, and they're generally careful with their financial risk framework. But when they do make a big movie, when anybody makes a big movie, it can cost tens of millions of dollars to produce and tens of millions more just to market it. So when you think about a lot of the generative AI examples we all see online, it's largely audio and visual, AV. So video production, photo editing, intelligent voice response, etc. Now, I don't think anybody wants AI-generated scripts or actors, and the industry rightfully won't allow it. We need to preserve the human touch. That's very important. However, these tools are all highly applicable to a studio's business and can expedite pre- and post-production processes that are rather costly and time-consuming. For example, AI can help generate sample videos based off initial scripts to help executives visualize a potential movie and make a decision on whether to greenlight it. And when a movie is done filming, AI can expedite special effects, editing, error corrections, trailer development, subtitles. I mean, the list just goes on. Marketing, I mentioned, is a huge cost. Marketing efficiency can also greatly improve by using AI to analyze their past content performance and better understand which demos to target for their new launches. We also believe AI can help surface pertinent content within Lionsgate's vast library to then identify and license that content out to a wider array of potential buyers, maybe at even higher prices, all of which would boost revenue growth. And it's important, in our view, to recognize why larger studios will win here. And it's because they have these huge content libraries that will feed what seem to be proprietary AI models. These libraries of content already formed the basis of their strategic value and core profitability. But in an AI era, I think the value of owning content is getting much bigger. You'll notice that I'm not talking so much about using AI to just cut heads versus augmenting the productivity of existing talent and resources, which can drive faster growth at much higher incremental margins. If you can generate tens of millions of savings per blockbuster movie and you're doing a few blockbuster movies per year, that's a very tangible impact for a company like Lionsgate that, on the studio side, makes $300 to $400 million in EBITDA annually. So we're talking about a very tangible impact here. And I'm fairly confident that you'll also get a higher multiple on that profit as well, either in the public markets or from a strategic acquirer, whichever path maximizes value.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I was just reading a UBS report about Adobe. Coca-Cola released its annual holiday commercial that was entirely AI generated. And the report talked about the impact on Adobe's AI stuff. So it feels like AI is intervening in all aspects of our life. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And I liked your comment that it's to support the creatives at Lionsgate, but not replace them. Those all sounded like fascinating ideas. So it'll be interesting to see how AI factors into investment decisions in the months and years to come. And clearly, we have to be thoughtful about how AI will impact these companies. Okay, we are out of time. You've been listening to the 100th episode of the Activist Investing Today podcast. And we've been talking to Sagar Gupta, who heads Activist Investing at Anson. Thank you for taking the time, Sagar.
Thanks so much, Ron. We really appreciate it.